Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of 24 such lodges situated around the globe, and each is an independent effort by local volunteers to keep the philosophy of theosophy before the public. And having said that, we are alert to the fact that each of the locations is autonomous and is governed by a few sweet paragraphs of the Declaration that can be found on the back of the periodical. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And as was just said, this is the back of the periodical, and the new periodical for the new quarter is just arrived by Pony Express. So we have one for October, November, and December that you can pick up on your way out of the building. Now we are in a state of transition in Philadelphia. Just as the summer is just over, we are ending our summer study efforts, and on Wednesday, the first Wednesday in October, the new periodical will guide you through the activities for the month of October. But all of the efforts that you see around you, Wednesdays and Sundays, everything that keeps the building going, that keeps the classes in session, the library going, the book table going, everything imaginable is done on the voluntary basis of an association of freethinkers who are looking at the philosophy and themselves to have a better idea of how to apply it in daily life. If you would like to avail yourself of volunteerism, you can talk to the student who's at the book table before or after class or during library hours. So starting Wednesday, the building will open at 5:15 promptly. There will be a student volunteer available in the reference library. And what will be available is all straight line theosophical materials. The part for that Wednesday night class, which this Wednesday will kick off the Ocean of Theosophy, a collation of articles by William Q. Judge from the late 1800s. The reference material will be available. And as was said, if you'd like to discuss volunteering, the book table is also concurrently open at 5:15 with a student there to assist in either the selection or perusal of materials for home use. All materials at the book table are offered at cost. They can also be accessible online, and the student at the book table can explain how to do that as well. On Wednesday evenings, then at 7:15, the library will close. There'll be a brief break, and at 7:30, the ocean study class will start. And there will also be opportunities for someone to give the declaration and the announcements, or someone to give the fundamental propositions. All efforts are welcome, certainly. October is also, in addition to the beginning of the winter season, our new year here at the Lodge. October has a different theme for what Sunday presentations look like and sound like, and where we're going. The building opens at 10:30 on Sundays. There is a student again at the book table for assistance, and at 11 o'clock promptly, a class like this one begins. So for the month of October, the theme is Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement. October 6th, which is the first Sunday, the title will be What is the Aim and Purpose of Theosophy? Sure to be a good presentation. Those presentations are a little more formal than what the Sundays in the summer have been like. And certainly more formal than Wednesday night classes. You might hear a forum talk, you might hear a panel, you might hear a longer talk, but there's always time, ample time, for questions and answers. So that's where we're going. But where we are today is still in the summer session, finishing up the summer discussion and shared reading of The Light on the Path, a treatise that was written down by a student of theosophy, collated from original texts that are ancient and very, very pure. Just as a reminder, in July, we began to consider the opening of The Light on the Path in a variety of different ways. So these are the rules that were written for all disciples, and this is the basis for this concluding class this morning. These are the rules written for all disciples. Attend you to them. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. So that's what we've been doing for a couple of months, and without any further ado, we are on page 80. At the back of the little devotional book. And there will be a student volunteer who will summarize everything from page 80 to the conclusion on page 90.
Summarizing this last part, it was very difficult to pick out the most salient points because the whole part was important. But we will try to summarize as best as we can, and then if there's any questions that aren't covered, we can certainly take it up after the summary is done. So there's actually two parts for this summary for the end of the book. As was said, the rules that were read, we're looking at the last one, before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. And then the last part, we'll be looking at how karma fits in to this whole piece. So we'll be trying to segue the rule into the idea of karma. So the word soul, when it says before the soul can stand, the part actually says that, as used here, it's actually looking at being used as the divine soul or starry spirit. And the whole idea of standing actually is indicated here as to be confident, to be strong. The disciple should be confident in himself in order to do what he needs to do. And his whole consciousness, part of this confidence, should be that his whole focus should be on a divine life. And it says, which is this divine life, is expressed symbolically by the term the masters. The last part of this paragraph actually gives many examples of the divine life. But before it is possible for the disciple to start living this divine life, it says that the feet of the soul must be washed in the blood of the heart. And that the sacrifice or surrender of the heart also is looking at the emotions and the whole idea of trying to remain equal and centered with these, with your emotions. So what does this mean then when it talks about washed in the blood of the heart? So we know about the heart, we know it's a physical organ, but it's also the center of the emotions as well. So what about the blood then? But the part actually says that we're not looking at the liquid part of the blood that carries oxygen and nourishes the body, but that it is a vital creative principle in man's nature, which drives him into human life in order to experience pain, pleasure, joy, and sorrow. So when this blood flows then from the heart, the disciple then is able to stand with confidence before the masters as a spirit that is pure and that no longer wishes to incarnate because of experience, the person's experience and emotion. So when the soul then does take a form in flesh, he is doing it to accomplish the work of the masters. Now, we're going to go on into the section on karma, but when the part had mentioned about experiencing pain and pleasure, joy and sorrow, we know that karma can bring forth from past lives these experiences and these choices as to what will happen now that the disciple will be dealing with. Because as we'll see, once a person has embarked on this idea of occultism, it like pushes forward a lot more experiences that the soul's gonna have to experience. So the first part, there's a long, in the section on karma, there's a long analogy comparing the individual existence to a rope, and that the rope never on Twines, but it does have experiences. It has what it's called, suffers strange accidents. And it's just like with human lives over the course of time that the soul does experience many different experiences and suffer strange accidents, as is mentioned here. So the rope being the form of the individual. But the whole idea is for this rope, these lives, to form a cohesive whole. And from that harmony, it says, within the greater harmony is perceived. And there's a couple of paragraphs down on 86. There is an interesting sentence. It says, not that the future is arbitrarily formed by any separate acts of the present, but that the whole of the future is in unbroken continuity with the present, as the present is with the past. So the present is the, you know, when we're looking at a scale for balancing, the present could be the center part, the past is on one side, and the future is in another, but it is the present that is pulling everything together. And again, we're looking at the attention given to occultism when one decides to go on this path. It says produces great karmic results. And all of this is based on choices of good and evil, that depending upon how one chooses, how the disciple chooses, will determine the karmic life then. And the first thing that the student needs to do in occultism is to obtain knowledge. And again, this knowledge has to be chosen. excuse us. You know, are these choices of this knowledge going to take him down an evil path or a positive path? But no matter what, once the student gets on the road to occultism, these will be great karmic results. And one of the things that needs to be chosen is the desire to, as they put it, sow no seed for your own harvesting, desire only to sow the seed, the fruit of which shall feed the world. But one also has, when one is thinking that way, they're also talking about this thought lurks a great danger, because one can actually think that they're sowing these seeds for others, whereas in reality it could be something that they're choosing for themselves. So, on page 89, towards the bottom, talking about, there's a warning is given about turning, you know, the disciple or the student trying to go onto the path of occultism, that there is no cure for desire, no cure for the love of reward. And we know from our studies in the Bhagavad Gita that that is a major focus of the Bhagavad Gita, that no matter what we do, we shouldn't be looking for a reward. And to live in the eternal. So to end, we'll just say, therefore, you who desire to understand the laws of karma, attempt first to free yourself from these laws, and this can only be done by fixing your attention on that which is unaffected by those laws.
Thank you. tiny little book, but oh my goodness, these last pages pack a wallop, don't they? Yes?
In the part, rope was used.
Yes.
Was it used for the soul as a matter, like the thread soul, or is it something different in this instance?
We're back on page 85. It says, consider with me that the individual existence is a rope which stretches from the infinite to the infinite and has no end and no commencement, neither is it capable of being broken. So that rope is that divine, personal, divine individuality, having nothing to do with a particular personality or a brain or anything finite on this plane, but rather the rope is being used as this ageless, limitless set of expressions of spirit into matter. Yeah?
Yeah, the reason we asked was the Sutratma, the thread soul, sounds like that's very similar, if not exactly the same thing.
It does. Yeah, it absolutely does. And so that would be an individual study from the East that one might want to do. The other, the other study that's very available during library hours and thereafter is this rope is formed of innumerable fine threads. They are colorless. They start out straight and strong and level, and then across time become stained with dirt or with color. But the threads are living, are like electric wires, more are like quivering nerves. So we may want to do a study on the skandhas and the points of intelligence in nature and how that might be akin to this rope analogy. Your hand went up.
Yeah, it's just that the thread soul is a way of describing the permanent ego. But this is speaking of existence, the individual existence. So it's the experiences that that individuality has that colors this and stains this rope. It is not the, we hate to use the word permanent, but it is not the permanent spiritual ego that's being talked about, but the individuality's experiences in existence.
Well, both things are being described, because the analogy starts describing the fact that from the divine, the origin of the threads is pure and straight and harmonious and colorless. And that then, through use of incarnations and the filters of the lower self, the personality, then they become dirty, twisted, knotted, colored, etc., etc., etc. And it is through the effort, we're told, of that divine, ageless, spiritual soul, not through the decisions and efforts of the personality, but from the basis of above, that through effort, the threads can become no longer colorless, but they move from shadow into shine and become golden, once more lined together, level and harmonious. So both things are being described, but there is only one in all the essence of manifestation. There's one source, that divine essence, the highest we can imagine of spiritual soul, of mastery shining over manifestation, and then all the degrees, all the way down of the use of mind, can impact, and this analogy is trying to show that. Is that better?
Well, just that I think that the very description of the stainless belongs to the thread sole. But when we start talking about coming forth out of that pariah state, we bring with us the stains of the past that have yet to be resolved. So we think there's a little bit of study to be done between the two ideas. But isn't there a little bit of study to be done between everything?
Yes, and it's not book study, is it? I'm sorry about the coffee. In the Declaration, when we're invited to fit ourselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others, we're invited not to read words literally, not to spend all of our time in an intellectual pursuit or debate, but rather to make the effort to meditate, to contemplate, to read between the lines, to look at a word like the word golden, and, well, what does that mean? What does that bring back to mind? And it's that kind of in-depth study, that meditation, that soul study, that's additionally called for here. But yeah, this is a study for lifetimes, is it not? And this was recorded by a sincere student, someone making an effort, and then commenting on the effort. And as students, we can join in that process of considering and trying to line up what intuitively seems correct. The last portion of that comment is a very vital one. That karma is, if we think fundamentally of the philosophy describing the oneness of the absolute, and with the attributes of periodically coming forth from the rest state into the activity state, of periodically being cause and effect, of that oneness of all of spirit blooming with an evolution of self, the personal being raised by the higher, the highest we can imagine. Karma is, it is ongoing. So, if this is timeless and unbroken and doesn't have a beginning and doesn't have an end, then all efforts that have been banked, shall we say, all efforts that have been impressed with aspiration, some degree of desire, all those efforts carry with them an echo. For each cause, there's an effect. And we know that then there's the interaction of cause and effect and how we respond to it anew. So that's why the advice in this portion is not to become too involved in the mundane and too worried about, if I eat this way, I'm going to produce that kind of thought. If I do this practice in life, I'll produce this kind of thought. But rather, the effort is invited to look into an analogy like this one and try to see the eternal, try to see the lesson of it. And by focusing on as high a spiritual plane as we can imagine, everything else will fall into place. Yeah.
So the study is mainly self-study. Book study is, of course, important, but isn't it mostly self-study, the long journey that we through embodied existence, life after life? It's for life and lives. It's
for life and lives. And we all know that when we first, however, we stumbled across the philosophy, many of us quickly began to collect literature and to find quotes that were awesome because they seemed so familiar. They echoed what we'd been thinking for maybe decades in this particular incarnation. And then as time goes on, the effort begins to expand. It's almost like we dropped a pebble in a pond, and the results become, wait a second, if I can see more and more, if I'm reading this part, and the Sutratma comes to mind, if I'm reading this part and the skandhas come to mind, it's more and more like putting a jigsaw puzzle together, where we're piecing together things that we've read, heard, with what we've experienced, and then looking at our own plane of experiment, our own experience, and figuring out, does this go together? How does it go together? And what's my best effort? Way in the back.
Can we change the subject?
Sure.
We've been pondering, you know, the rule says before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. Are we looking at the feet as an analogy maybe for maybe like lower mind that has to be cleaned up? We kept trying to think about what is meant by feet.
Well, yes?
It's where I stand. It's how I stand. It's how I perceive the world and how I move through it.
And feet are very interesting, aren't they? If you think about the practice of reflexology and how all the nerve endings of the physical frame come into the feet and different portions of the feet affect organ function. There are folks that want very, very much to practice their daily rituals barefoot, especially if they're walking in grass or part of nature or on soil or in salt water or on the beach. So there's lots of different ways to look at that. But truly, the root for our incarnation right now in this particular form is that soul is moving through a human state that stands erect on feet. So from head to toe, from heart to brain to all aspects, there has to be a cleansing. There has to be a washing away of all of the damage, all of the experience, all of the tainting, if you will, of past lives and current lives. Yes?
So it ends about, part ends with the doing away of all the karma. So when we, what's our goal? Is it to do away with it so we can reach nirvana and just be done with the world? Or is there something deeper there?
Well, there's said to be two paths. And we can read about those paths in the Gita. We can read about them in the Voice of the Silence. There is the path. There are those who lead very pure lives in an outward expression. Every effort they make is to not create any new karma, but it's motive that rules. So if the motive is, as soul, I want to escape all karma, I want to get out of this plane of learning and sorrow, and I want to retreat into this eternal, or what appears to be an eternal state of bliss, then that's very selfish, very self-centered, very selfish. It carries with it karmic effect, generates karma. If the goal is to help and teach others to work on with great nature, to cure the ills of the world, to assist in empowering all other points of intelligence to be uplifted and to uplift one another. If that's the goal, then as we begin to study self and as we begin to look at karma and we begin to see there are tendencies from the past, there are tendencies from the future coming at us, in this moment, it's just best to say, okay, all those influences exist. The brain and the personality are part of an external environment. But best just to back up and look at it and think about it and try to make an effort to understand it and transmute it as best we can. But we know from the Gita study from the summer that no effort is lost, that karma, you know, the past is rushing right back at us in the future, and we stand in that pivotal, eternal, present moment where the power is in the pause, where the power remains awareness and discernment, where we can look at motive and say, oh, wait a second here, that's a mixed bag. And then we can back off something. So we can err, to err is human. To correct, to forgive is divine. That's from the upper. That's from the highest. Yes?
Well, we can't ever escape karma.
Right.
It is the law of life. What we can do is begin to understand it and to agree with it, to accept what comes as our own lesson, and get to the point where we're not acting for rewards, and then that makes us karma less, because if we're not looking for anything, what can come back to us but knowledge?
Absolutely. In the effort to try to gain enlightenment, each of us has to come to a point where we realize that there's no cure for the outward expressions. There's no vicarious atonement. There's no magic wand. There's no escapism. It is what it is. The effects on a nation, the effects on a family, the effects on a region of the world, on the world itself, the globe itself, those effects are. Those conditions are going to change and ebb and flow, and they will be. So the cure is not to look at that external, because there is no cure. That those changing degrees of manifestation will continue. And so what we're told to do on the bottom of page 89 is fix the sight and hearing upon that which is invisible and soundless. Begin even now to practice it, and so 1,000 serpents will be kept from your path. Live in the eternal. So if we are turning mind and turning our reactions to life back to the universal principles, back to trust in karma, faith in karma, confidence that I can stand up in the morning and face what is coming at me, and that in those experiences are lessons, incredible lessons, and that the education of karma is all important to the whole, to all degrees of manifestation. But it's in the human state that potent decisions can be made, because that's where the highest degrees of spirit can override all the degrees of mind and substance within. That voice of the silence from conscience, from memory, if you will, of wisdom gained in prior existences. Maybe what we even knew in the sandbox when we were kids. Yeah.
A number of months ago, a student in the chair of a meeting advised us, turn off your television. And we took their advice and it changed our life. Because you are constantly in a snare of either entertainment or ghastly news. And in the silence, you are able to remember what you already have learned, but you couldn't hear it through the noise. So we think it's very good advice.
It's good advice, and it's an analogy for what we do internally. You know, truly the effort of rising for the day and turning off the monkey mind, turning off the noise, turning off, yikes, I've got this busyness to do and all these duties to do. Turning that off and retuning the channel back to spiritual oneness, back to, well, how do I endeavor to make theosophy, to make divine wisdom a power in this life? What process of thinking and feeling and compassion can go into that? Holding that channel open on the inside and then proceeding through the day eliminates the mundane entertainment and the ghastly news. And somebody else's spin on what that ghastly news is. Yeah.
Which kind of makes sense, because if we consider, you know, before the disciple can stand in the presence of the master, his feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. If we're letting in all the garbage, literally, and watching, and you know, our experts on everything in DC and Europe and all this, our feet are being washed in the opinions and the emotions and the lies of somebody else who we don't even know. And if that's what you like, fine. But how much time does one have to make the effort to wash his feet in the blood of the heart? You know, on the one hand, we can say, oh, 24/7 doesn't work. You've got to turn stuff off and take time to focus on things that matter. And what better thing to push off is the garbage, you know? Because it doesn't just work for children. You know, we hear about, you know, if a parent doesn't fill their children's mind with what they want it to be filled with, somebody else will. Well, that goes on all life long if you're addicted to the opinions of other people and to the TV mostly.
And that statement, being addicted to the opinions of other people, karmically, the fortunate child is the child that comes into a home where thinking for oneself is honored, where the tendencies and the talents of that child are brought forward and supplemented. Because the child and its spiritual nature is being honored, if you will. But most of us karmically come into homes where obedience is greatly valued. Certainly if the home has a scenario where there's multiple children or both parent partners are working full time, the child can be raised in a scenario where they become addicted to the opinions of the elders, whether it's care providers or parents or teachers. Then what happens to a child by puberty? The opportunities begin to spin, and that child addicted to the opinions of others is now looking for gratification and affirmation from peer groups who frequently are flying blind, as we all know. So that addiction to being outward leaning, the addiction of being all set to take orders or to swallow hook, line, and sinker, whatever we're hearing or we're taught, is something that many of us, as we begin to study comparative religion and look at philosophy and try to understand where science dovetails with the other two, we'll trip over facts of nature that we just know because somebody told us decades before, and it's ingrained. And that aha moment of, whoa, there was quite a proposition. That was quite an assumption that I was using. Let's weed that one out. That's why these gatherings are so valuable, because we come together and we help each other look at it. So that turn off the TV, turn off the radio, stop looking at Facebook or the news feed on a telephone, and invest precious time in a different process. The blood that is essential, a vital, creative principle in man's nature. It's a whole different ballgame. Yes?
Reflecting back onto the comment that was made a little earlier about looking for the allegory of the feet, and if it was presented about the lower mind, I think the way that I take it is that the blood of the heart is really representing the passions and the desires of the human being, and maybe looking allegorically that the feet are the astral body, and the feet are representing the forward progress, and that as is stated earlier in the book, killing your ambition and these other things that I spoken of earlier, that's like that's helping the astral body, because that's not the final stage either, but that's like a stage in it. So like the blood of the heart, and the way I'm interpreting it is like it's like the passions and the desires that is like sacrifice for the path.
Well, definitely as soul we use different degrees of substance, and in each of those planes of substance, we have what's called a different principle with contacting the substance. And the comment about physical passions and desires being part of that astral, those are definitely the lower grades of all those degrees of substance that's being used. The part on page 82 says that it's not the material appearance that the blood expresses. It is not the blood that's essential for physical life, but a vital, creative principle in man's nature. So as we're thinking about man's nature, and we're thinking about what is it that pulses through the human kingdom that would be more like, what was the expression? Starry spirit. Is that astral, or is that something far above the astral plane? Yes?
But on page 81, it tells us it's also the emotional plane. The sacrifice or surrender of the heart of man and its emotions is the first of the rules. It involves the attaining of an equilibrium which cannot be shaken by personal emotion. So we think the questioner has a valid point, mm-hmm. that it's definitely the blood of the heart is the passions and desires. And if we can stand upright, holding those in abeyance so they're not controlling us, we're really moving along.
We're really moving along. And the other part of the study of the philosophy is that the true senses are in the astral form rather than in the physical form. And we know that so much of our emotions, so much of our energy that we generate as personalities, as thinkers, is imbued in that astral and is very shaky, is very tentative. It wavers. It's transitory. It doesn't have any strong, firm footing upon which to stand. So as we make the effort to clean that up, to not waver with emotions, to not sway with the breeze of opinions, as we make the effort to see the difference between astral potential and true spiritual power, as we make that effort, we begin to become stronger and stronger in our footing, in our standing. Yeah.
One way to see this that might be helpful is, you know, so often we think that we are either, you know, spirit and body or soul and body, and so we are metaphysical and we're physical. And in thinking that way, you know, which is of course true, but in thinking that way, we presume sometimes, we did, or, you know, at one point, that, okay, the physical is here today and gone tomorrow, but the metaphysical is always here. And that's not true, because in the metaphysical, there's the permanent and the impermanent. So one example of that would be the astral, yeah, it's there, but it's, as was said, it's, you know, everything fluctuates there, and there's nothing permanent about it. So it's something that we have to dissociate from and observe and control, if can be. But to identify with it and to give it credits might, and accept that as the reality, to accept motion and emotions and thoughts as the reality, we might be getting caught up in a maze that we're going to have to find our way out.
Yeah, yeah. What came to mind in thinking about this for this part were selections from The Key to Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky. You can come into the library hours or look up The Key on an internet site, and the person at the book table can help you find that email address. On pages 135 and 136, Blavatsky made the efforts to create proper terms for sacred ideas. And so Atma, Buddhi, Manas, Mahat, spiritual ego, starry substance, etc., etc., is all laid out in The Key. The other piece of The Key, now that was page 135, 136. If you also look at pages 175 and 176, there's a breakdown of the higher self is the Atma, the inseparable ray of the universal and oneself, the God above. Happy the man who succeeds in saturating his inner ego with it. The spiritual divine ego, a spiritual soul, or Buddhi, then is in close union with Manas, the mind principle. And then there's the inner or higher ego or Manas. There's the lower or personal ego. And the astral is part of that. Dilution is not the correct word. In the world of water, in the hydrologic system, water is, in its purest form, H2O. It's gaseous. It doesn't have any attributes or anything suspended in it. But we know that it becomes from gas to liquid to solid and back again, according to law, according to conditions. And this higher self, this spiritual divine ego, is the same way. It is pure in the absolute sense and then comes down into expressions that change in response to conditions available. And we're to try to understand what would it be like to be purely divinely human and to work from that spiritual divine ego, that higher or inner ego, as opposed to be animalistically human and to just use soul powers from the viewpoint of the personal, the physical, the astral. Yeah.
Well, one of the most interesting things one might have that many, many, many years ago, and even today, rope making was an art.
I'm sorry, please say.
Rope
making.
Was an art.
Yes.
And if we ourselves get a hold of a piece of rope, and just lay it on the table, look at it. And you'll see that it's made up of hundreds and hundreds of fibers or threads. You put one thread out, no problem at all, it'll break easy. But somehow, over time, we have learned how to make ropes based on a law of nature, and it is designed such that a single rope can, out of hundreds of pounds, can be supported by a small rope. Why? Because they have been put together in such a way, obeying such certain laws of nature, that it has triple the strength, no, 100 times the strength. Now what we can do here is lie on the path, compare that to ourselves, our being, the rights, etc., etc. But if we start with an article like this, and they mention rope, that's the first thing we should go look for, is rope, and say, why mention rope?
The comment brought to mind a colloquial expression: united we stand, divided we fall. And there is a spiritual reason why in the Declaration of ULT, unity, oneness, is so stressed as a starting point. So that the great heresy of separatism, of I'm okay, you're not okay, of us and them, that will be diminished and that will be extinguished as a concept with which to lead life. Because united as the fibers of the rope, united the astral, the physical, the mental, all these planes become incredibly powerful. And that's in one pointedness through one lens of one degree of what it is to be human. If we can then take that lens and refocus it yet again on a collectivity, on a unity of effort, how powerful, how potent that must indeed be. Our time is up. Please remember that the building will reopen 5:15 on Wednesday night. We have brand new periodicals available in the foyer. And please, if this sounds familiar to you or it's uplifting, please consider joining the effort. Have a great day.